Welcome to the Hunchback Hunter podcast. This is episode number 452, and we are continuing in our series, having conversations with state game and fish agencies. Now, I say continuing, but it's actually been a bit of a break. We have not released an episode in this series in a while, but as you may have heard earlier this year, we did release episodes with numerous states, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, and others. And today we have an episode with Colorado. I've been trying to get Colorado on the podcast since we started this initiative back at the beginning of the year, and I didn't know if it was going to happen, but finally it did. And part of the reason for the delay, I found out, was just the timing of some of their processes, which you'll hear more about in this conversation. So there is a ton going on in Colorado that many hunters are interested in and many hunters are concerned about. And of course, we can't answer every single question, but I did want to do my best to answer your questions. And most of those questions focused around two issues. One is the future opportunities of over-the-counter elk tags. There's been a lot of conversation about this, some rumors swirling online, and a whole lot more. And so I wanted to get very clear answers on where things stand and where it looks like things may be going as it relates to future over-the-counter opportunities in Colorado. And the second issue is wolves. And so we focused this conversation primarily on those two topics. And within each of those topics, I focused it primarily on your questions. So thank you, as always, to all of the listeners for submitting questions. And thank you to Colorado Parks and Wildlife for joining us today. I encourage all of you guys to do your own research and get involved. One single podcast is not going to answer all questions. It's not even going to tell all sides of the story. So do your own research, get involved. And as you'll hear about, there's a lot of important topics at stake in the future. As always, guys, if you have any questions, feedback, or comments for us, you can email podcast@exomongear.com. If you're enjoying the show, it would help us tremendously if you can share it with a friend or leave a rating or review in whatever podcast app you're using. But right now, let's get right into this conversation with John and Brandon from Colorado Parks and Wildlife. Appreciate you guys joining us on the podcast today. Start with each of you, just kind of an introduction, background, who you are, whatever you want to share there, whether that's kind of personally or, you know, stick to the professional role and obviously your role within Colorado Parks and Wildlife, if we can kick that off with you, John.
Sure. So yeah, my name is John Livingston. I'm a public information officer for Colorado Parks and Wildlife in our Southwest region. I'm obviously a bit biased, but I think the Southwest region is the most beautiful and most incredible parts of Colorado. We have Brandon Diamonds Country up there in Gunnison, Crested Butte area, all the way over to our Montrose, Delta, Ridgeway, Ouray, Telluride areas, the whole San Luis Valley as well, and then over Durango, Pagosa, Cortez, Dolores, those kind of areas. So helping our public outreach efforts there. My background's actually in journalism. As I was a sports editor at a newspaper for a long time, but I was anxious to get somewhere where I felt like I could still have a great impact in the work I do. I really care about the mission of Colorado Parks and Wildlife, and also just wanted somewhere where I could see myself working for a long time. What I love about Parks and Wildlife is we got so many dedicated employees who have spent 30 plus years with the agency and just are a wealth of knowledge. I go into work every day and learn something new from people like Brandon and our biologists, our water specialists, our land use folks. And no matter who it is, I feel like I'm walking out of there with a new bit of knowledge every day. So yeah, just really enjoy the opportunity. I went on my first elk hunt actually last year. Grew up with my uncle in Wisconsin, would go whitetail hunting, but I was never, you know, the guy behind the trigger, getting any opportunities to harvest anything. And getting back into it here at Parks and Wildlife, been here about 3 years now, and I got to go do a mentored hunt last year, and got an opportunity to go hunt pheasants over in West Virginia a couple weeks ago for a work program I was involved in, and looking forward to hopefully getting out next month on a spring turkey hunt. So really trying to dive in and learn everything and get involved with the community as much as I can.
Awesome. How about for you, Brandon?
Hey, good morning, Mark. We really appreciate you having us. I really enjoy being able to answer questions and put information out there so that folks are as well informed as they can possibly be. My name is Brandon Diamond, and I'm the Area Wildlife Manager for Colorado Parks and Wildlife in Gunnison. And my area is what we call Area 16, so we actually cover all of the Gunnison Basin, as well as the North Fork of the Gunnison River Valley, which includes the towns of Paonia, Hotchkiss, and Cedar Ridge. And so our area is big, it's very diverse, lots of wildlife, lots of people, lots of issues that we're trying to navigate through. I was born and raised in Colorado, Colorado kid. I'm fortunate that I've been able to work in the Southwest region for most of my professional career. I've had a few different jobs with Colorado Parks and Wildlife. I was hired when we were the Division of Wildlife, and since then we've merged with State Parks, so we're now Parks and Wildlife. But when I started, I was the District Wildlife Manager, the game warden for the Nuclid District. So I was actually working out of the Montrose office. And then I was fortunate to move back to Gunnison, where I went to college with my wife. And I was the biologist, the big game biologist here for around 10 years. And then I switched back to District Wildlife Manager. I had the Gunnison Northwest District, which is largely the West Elks, the West Elk Wilderness, which was the district I always wanted. And since then, now I'm the Area Wildlife Manager. So I supervise operations here for Area 16. So I've been here for a while, enjoyed my time here, really appreciate what we have and don't take it for granted, but also, in full transparency, we're dealing with some significant issues these days in our part of the state and across Colorado. So we're doing our best for wildlife. And again, appreciate getting some of this information out and letting folks know what Colorado Parks and Wildlife is up to.
Yeah, I'm just showing my ignorance here. Wildlife manager, what all does that entail? And then it sounds like falling under you, you have district wildlife managers. Do biologists also report to you? I guess, like, what is that? Is the wildlife manager for the region? It sounds pretty all-encompassing.
No, good question. We do have a few different layers within that. So I supervise our district wildlife managers in Area 16. I supervise our office operations, and then I supervise our state wildlife area operations. So I have a hand, I have three property wildlife property technicians that work for me. So that's my staff. The biologists are actually under a separate section within the agency. And certainly we have to rely on each other and have good communication, because what biologists are planning and the work they're doing certainly has a nexus with what my staff is doing and what we're doing comprehensively. So we're in good communications, but they have different supervisors that are in different places around the state. So we do have a few different silos within.
Well, with all of the states, as we've done these episodes, we've just kind of started with the overview of applying to hunt in Colorado, of things like when is the application season, how do preference points or bonus points work, if there is a point system, et cetera. Obviously, as we're recording this, there still is some time to get in on the primary draw for most big game species, which I believe that deadline is in early April, correct?
That's correct. So yeah, we're essentially in the thick of the application season right now. So anyone interested in applying for a limited license can do that. The deadline for application is April 2nd. So the evening of, if you can get your applications in by close of business on April 2nd, that's probably a good plan. But yeah, right now you can go online and find our big game brochure. It's available online, or there are hard copies out there. We still do mail hard copies to folks if requested. and folks that have applied previously in Colorado may have already received their brochures in the mail. But yeah, take a minute to look through that. Make sure you don't miss the deadline if you're interested in a limited license for this upcoming fall. So all that is going now. I feel like our application brochure is fairly easy to understand and work through for the average hunter, whether you're a resident or a non-resident, but we're always happy to help with questions that come up. Every year we try to highlight the different changes that are occurring in the first part of the brochure. There'll be a What's New page where you can check out what's different between this year and last year. In Colorado, it depends. It depends on what species you want to hunt. We do still have some over-the-counter, what we call over-the-counter hunting opportunity in Colorado, mostly for elk. But otherwise, we do have a lot of limited licenses where, a limited number, a limited quota is developed and made available for folks to apply for. And so for mule deer, in Colorado, all of those licenses are totally limited. So if you want to hunt mule deer in Colorado, you do have to apply in our limited draw. The vast majority of our pronghorn licenses are limited. So again, you have to apply through the limited draw. We do have a fair number of limited elk licenses as well. But we also, during the second and third rifle seasons and during archery seasons right now, we do have some over-the-counter licenses that a hunter can still buy a week or a day in advance of their season. Species like sheep, goat, and moose are all limited licenses. And black bear, there's a variety of different opportunities for bears, limited licenses as well as licenses you can purchase as an add-on license if you come to Colorado and hunt with a bow or a muzzleloader, or a rifle. So it just depends on the species you're wanting to hunt and the season you want to hunt, the time of year you want to hunt. All of those kind of factor into what your options are. But again, the brochure is pretty clear in how it lays out those options, and we're happy to help. As far as our point system goes, Colorado mostly has a straight preference point system for our deer, elk, pronghorn, bear, deer, elk, pronghorn, and bear. Preference points are different than bonus points. And again, we don't have a bonus point system. We have a preference point system. So essentially, folks that have been in the draw longer, that have more points, have a better chance of drawing a limited license if the demand exceeds the supply. For sheep, goat, and moose, our system is a little bit different. We have what we call weighted points, which is a little bit more complicated to talk through than a bonus point system. But for sheep, goat, and moose, whether you're a resident or a non-resident, you have to accrue 3 preference points to start. So you'll have to apply for 3 years, get 3 preference points, and then it goes to a weighted point system on year 4. So it's not a straight preference point system. The weighted points play into that, and that's a little bit different than our straight preference point system for the other species, more commonly applied for species. I'll stop there and see if we want to take that in any direction.
No, I think that's a helpful overview. I will say I don't Colorado is, I don't know if it's my own familiarity with it, but it just does seem like one of the states that's a little bit more straightforward to understand as a non-resident, in terms of, yeah, just there's certain quirks in so many states, right? Like certain little things that are gotchas, and say like the examples come to mind of like Wyoming, how they'll have the same area could have different unit numbers for different species, or just, all kinds of quirks. Whereas I do feel that Colorado is more straightforward for people who are trying to understand everything from understanding areas to hunt and units, and then also just understanding the application process. As you said, the point system overall is pretty straightforward. Does get a little bit trickier with some of those kind of trophy species of like sheep and goats, for example. But yeah, that's all helpful too. Just have that overview for sure. I'm curious, that said, you mentioned in the front of the guidebook highlighting new or recent changes. And I know that at some level there's going to be changes every year, right? Is there anything in particular that's recent that you think is more noteworthy to kind of call out here for this coming hunting season and application year? So I'm not saying we need to go over every nitty-gritty change, but anything notable that we should probably kind of highlight to make folks aware of?
Yeah, and when we were sort of planning for the podcast, you had raised the issue of allocation between residents and non-residents, and I think that's one significant change that folks, if they haven't heard, they'd probably be interested in. Up until now, our license allocations between residents and non-residents have been 65-35, resident or non-resident. For hunt codes that take fewer than 6 points, I believe. And then we had some, I guess we would call them the more premium hunt codes that have higher demand. Hunt codes that took over 6 points had an 80-20 license allocation. And recently our Parks and Wildlife Commission did change that. Those changes are going into effect in this draw. So now, there's going to be a across the board 75-25 resident non-resident allocation for those lower hunt code or those lower preference point hunt codes. And then there's going to be an 80-20 for the higher preference point requirement hunt codes for residents and non-residents. So that change is pretty significant. In the past, it was 65-35 for resident non-resident. Now it will be 75-25 resident non-resident for a variety of those hunt codes. So that might put a little bit of a some turbulent, it will introduce some turbulence into the preference point system. And it's likely that we'll see some preference point creep for non-residents in different hunt codes. So just something to consider. That's a pretty significant change for this year.
Yeah, when you say kind of turbulence and changes on things like point creep and certain tags that are going to require different numbers of points and how that can fluctuate as based essentially on supply and demand. You also mentioned kind of these higher demand or lower demand units, not those phrases exactly, but this idea that there'd be different allocations based on the number of points required. How is that assessed? Every year, because those number of points, there could be units or certain tags for seasons within a unit that kind of shift from being maybe it was less than six, but now it's over six, and that could change in a year. Would that change the allocation for the following application year?
It could, yes, and so it's based on a 3 year average. So I
Okay.
think our intent now is to keep a running 3 year average of the preference point requirements, and it's based on resident demand. So if the 3 year preference point requirement jumps to six or more, that could trigger a hunt code to fall into the 80-20 category. Or if preference point requirements went down for some reason, it could change it back to the 75-25. But yeah, it's based on a running average of preference point requirements, so you can account for some of those different years and what folks are doing between years.
Can you maybe verbally explain the logic of kind of how that happens in the draw process? Meaning, say a 75-25 split. And so you have residents with points, you have non-residents with points. Logically, as this draw is happening, as this process is allocating tags based on applicants, is it taking 75% of those tags? And essentially running the draw just for residents, and then looking at a different pool of 25% of the tags and looking at non-residents. Like, is that, are those happening separately, or does kind of the logic or the flow of that draw process occur in some other way? I'm not sure if it's relatively easy to explain that verbally, the sequence of events, if you will.
Yeah, well, I think in my simple mind, the easiest way to explain it is, if you have 10 licenses and it's a hunt code that takes, let's just say it falls into the 80-20 category, because it requires six or more preference points for a resident. If you have 10 licenses, the way I look at it and the way a hunter might look at it for planning purposes would be 10 licenses. If the unit is totally limited for elk or mule deer, 20% of those licenses on the West Slope are going to go into the landowner preference program license allocation. And that's a different topic, but those licenses go to landowners that qualify for our program requirements. And so if 20% of those licenses are gone, then you have 8 licenses left for the public draw, for lack of a better term. And you would take those 8 licenses and you would partition that. You would take 20% of those licenses, and that would be what non-residents would be eligible for. And then you would take the other 80%, and that is what residents would be eligible for. And then, if the resident demand is there, they're going to draw all 80% of those licenses, and they'll be gone. And then the non-residents would be eligible for the 20% of the licenses that are remaining. So that's how I look at it, because that's truly, if the resident demand is there, the residents will get their allocation of licenses first. Yeah. And then non-residents will claim their 20%. Now, with that said, our caps, those allocations are soft caps in Colorado. So if the demand from residents is not there, non-residents could draw more than their allocation, but that just depends on what residents are choosing to do within that hunt code.
Yeah, that's helpful.
Yeah.
Is that landowner slice of the pie, is that kind of fixed at 20% for the most part across the board in terms of like areas, species, seasons?
In totally limited units, yes. So those allocations, it's a program that's based in Colorado statute and regulation. And on the west of I-25, it's 20%. I think east of I-25, it's 25%. It's a little bit more. And that's based on there's much more private land in eastern Colorado. So that was a consideration when they were making that determination. But yeah, on the west of I-25, it's 20% of the licenses fall into the landowner preference program pool. And that if you've ever heard, you probably have, when folks talk about landowner vouchers in Colorado, if landowners draw those licenses, they can sell them. And that's how some people hunt a little bit more frequently if they're buying landowner vouchers. But those vouchers come from the landowner preference program, which we commonly call LPP.
You mentioned two separate words there, and I already blinked on them. But I think it leads into the next kind of broader topic I wanted to touch on. I think you mentioned, was it regulation and something else, a policy maybe?
Statute.
Statute.
Yeah.
Okay. So with all the states as we've had these conversations, I've found it helpful to try and take somewhat of a 30,000 foot view on understanding the different entities, for lack of better terms, that are involved with essentially any policy, statute, etc., that affects hunters. I think a lot of us as hunters haven't had a great full understanding of how changes happen, how policy decisions happen, etc. And it's been helpful for me to understand as we look at each state, kind of the differences between, say, Colorado Parks and Wildlife versus, I'm not sure all the terms, and this is why I want to hear it, but like the commission or legislature, and really just have a better understanding, again, kind of 30,000 foot view to begin with, of these different entities and how they affect essentially what hunters see on the ground. Like whether that's tag allocations, whether it's, certain changes and regulations on equipment, like all those different things. So, can you kind of help us understand for Colorado? There's Colorado Parks and Wildlife. There's also some sort of commission. There's also legislation. Like, what does that look like? What are those entities? And then, I guess, what roles do they have in creating change within Colorado?
Sure. No, I'm glad you bring it up because it is, people talk about these things a lot more these days. You know, as our state becomes more complicated and more populated, folks want to know. And John, feel free to jump in if you want to interject on anything. But I guess, you know, where I would start is that Colorado Parks and Wildlife is a division of the Department of Natural Resources. And we're all state government agencies. Ultimately, the governor of Colorado could be considered our ultimate boss, because the governor is at the top of the pyramid there in terms of our agency. So you have the governor, and he or she, depending on the administration, are determining who is running the Department of Natural Resources. The Department of Natural Resources has oversight over the Division of Colorado Parks and Wildlife. And so, yeah, we are a straight up state government organization. We are the primary wildlife management agency in the state, amongst the other things that we do. But that's sort of how the hierarchy works. Now, within Colorado Parks and Wildlife, our governing body is the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Commission. And the Parks and Wildlife Commission, and if folks are interested in seeing the makeup of the commission and the specific members that are on the commission now, it's all on our Colorado Parks and Wildlife website. But our commissioners are appointed by the governor, and so it is a political appointee. But the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Commission are, like I said, they're our governing body that is responsible for establishing policy for the agency and regulation. And so, as a law enforcement officer, to put this in a little bit of context, as a law enforcement officer, when we're in the field checking hunters and anglers and we're enforcing the laws, we basically have two types of laws. One type are regulations. And so those are our Parks and Wildlife Commission regulations that folks can also look at on our websites. We have a whole chapter dedicated to fishing. We have a whole chapter dedicated to big game hunting. We have a whole chapter dedicated to small game hunting, and so on. And those regulations are, good examples of regulations are manners of take. What types of archery equipment can you use during archery season? What times of day can you hunt or trap? A half hour before sunrise and a half hour after sunset. All those sorts of things are regulations that, generally come from the field staff in Parks and Wildlife, and then that goes before our commission, and the commission, vets those regulations and discusses and debates them, and then ultimately has final say over what final regulations look like. So that's how our commission works. The other types of laws that wildlife officers enforce are statutory laws. So in Colorado, those are mostly encompassed by Title 33 of the Colorado Revised Statutes. So within Title 33, there are statutes and statutory violations that we look at. A good example would be the illegal take or possession of an elk out of season. Those are statutory violations that carry big fine amounts. And they also carry what we call suspension points. And if a hunter gets 20 or more suspension points over 5 years, they could be suspended from hunting and fishing in Colorado. So statutes are different than regulations because statutes are created and approved at the Colorado legislature. So those are our senators and our congressmen and women that are in legislative session right now, and they're the ones that are introducing bills that result in statutes and statutory provisions. And so it is a pretty complicated machine that's working out there in the background all the time on an annual basis. And of course, we're all interfacing with one another, because we have senators and Congress people that, they run bills that benefit our agency. If there are bills that, our agency might not necessarily support and that the governor doesn't support, there's interface. The governor doesn't support, there's interface there. So we're always talking and communicating. Same with our Colorado Parks and Wildlife Commission. We're trying to keep good lines of communication and doing what's best for the resource and for our mission. But there are a lot of different tiers that affect our agency. The other thing that I would say that folks ask a lot, and we hear a lot, is that, we folks, Colorado residents that pay taxes, think that they're paying for Colorado Parks and Wildlife salaries, projects, equipment through income taxes, which isn't the case. And that's something that I'm sure you all have talked about on your podcast before, and folks talk about a lot, is the North American model of wildlife conservation, where hunters and anglers, and there are other funding streams that come into it, but largely, it's sort of a pay-to-play system where hunters and anglers are paying the vast majority of our operational costs through their license dollars. And the same is true with our state parks. Parks pass holders and parks users pay for a lot of what goes on our parks and keeps our parks thriving. So it's kind of a neat system that, the hunting and angling community and others are proud of. And again, we're not necessarily using any income taxes revenues throughout the year and general fund dollars throughout the year. So there's a lot to unpack there and a lot of information at once, but we can go wherever we want to go with that, unless John has anything to add.
Yeah, Brandon, I would just add that, when you're talking about the Parks and Wildlife Commission, it's an 11-member board and it's a citizen board, folks volunteering their time, which a huge commitment. We're traveling all over the state for upwards of 10 meetings a year, or when we're dealing with like the wolf reintroduction process that we had over the last couple of years, just a ton of public outreach and meetings all over the state. The makeup of the Parks and Wildlife Commission is to look like three members who are sports persons, one of whom must be an outfitter. We've got three agricultural producers appointed into that commission, three recreationists, including one from a nonprofit, a non-consumptive wildlife organization, and then we also have two at-large members. And all these members are expected to represent parks and wildlife-related issues. And also a note for that for our folks on the Western Slope, a minimum of four of those commissioners must be from west of the Continental Divide. So the goal there really being to represent all facets of outdoor use with sports persons, outdoor recreation. There are some statutory requirements there. If you're going to represent sports persons on the commission, you're supposed to have, held a Colorado hunting license for 3 consecutive years. And just certain, kind of qualifications when you're looking for applying for that. And again, those are governor appointed citizen board members, and then they go through confirmation hearings at the state Senate level to get confirmed to those appointments. And Brandon, I don't know, maybe you can help me out. I don't have it on the top of my head how long those terms are for each appointment, but it seems like every, year or a few years, we've got a couple of folks kind of shuffling in and out and some new faces on that commission.
I'd have to look that up, John, to make sure I'm correct with. I know it's over 2 years. It may be 4 years. So they're pretty significant commitments for the folks that take on those responsibilities. The other thing I would say, Mark, is that if any of your listeners or folks are interested in seeing how a commission meeting runs, they're all recorded now and warehoused or archived on YouTube, John, I think. So you can go back and you can watch the meetings at your leisure, and just they're I would encourage all sports people to do that. They're fascinating to see how they work and just to see how the dynamic is, and take a get a snapshot of 2024 Colorado wildlife management.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I recommend folks, even if you're not able to watch those live streaming on our YouTube channel, like Brandon said, they're all recorded back on there. And, our agendas get posted pretty well in advance. So if there's specific topics you're specifically interested in, maybe from the office or wherever you are, maybe tune in at certain times of the day when you see stuff pop up on the agenda. For me, it's such a fascinating process to see the way a lot of, the process in which items and staff recommendations and public outreach gets to the commission level. Brandon here is involved in a lot of working groups where staff internally years out ahead of some major planning processes, whether that be things like big game season structure, which is a 5 year we're looking at season structure dates. All those different kind of things on a 5 year basis. But, that really starts at the staff level, sometimes years in advance of before they get to the commission level. And then there's that whole public outreach period where we're going out meeting with folks in all of our local communities and taking online feedback from in-state and out-of-state hunters. And then, taking those recommendations, forming staff recommendations, and then taking that up to the commission level, and then the commission listening to the, what the staff recommendation was versus what a lot of the public comment is, and then, deliberating, and then, after a couple of months of getting that public feedback and listening to staff, then voting on, various policies here. So, really just kind of a fascinating process to watch play out kind of from that start, most basic, hey, let's form a group who should be on that working group level to seeing things through to, being completed with a commission vote.
So the just real quick the that composition of the commission, I wasn't I knew there was some structure to how that was comprised of different interests essentially. I wasn't clear that it was that detailed though, which is interesting to hear. But and then term limits, which we're not sure, but we think 2, maybe 4 years on the commission. So if say the non-consumptive wildlife representative of the commission, their term for that individual is expiring. The governor is appointing someone new, but has to obviously fall within that same type of interest or representation of, in this case, non-consumptive wildlife to fill the position of the person who's outgoing, essentially.
Yeah, that's essentially the idea.
And then can, if that term limit is 2 or 4 years, that same representative, that same member of the commission can't serve again for another term. It's like a one and done deal.
No, folks can be reappointed.
Okay.
Yeah, so that would be at the discretion of the governor once their term was up.
All right. Well, getting into listener questions and this, some of this will maybe tie back into the commission and how these changes are taking place or being proposed or in progress, etc. I guess let me throw out the big, I'll throw out one question as an example of a big topic. There's a lot of sub questions. I have a feeling that some of our discussion will answer them. If not, I will ask clarifying questions. But let me just throw this one out here to open up the floor. This listener question said, the rumor is that over-the-counter archery elk tags are going away in Colorado. Is there any truth to that? So, good basis to start a discussion on a big topic, Brandon.
Yeah, so John mentioned this a minute ago, but in Colorado, we as far as big game management goes, one of our overarching policy documents, I guess I would call it, is relates to our 5-year season structure. And so we plan for 5 years of season structure. And that's sort of the system that we've always done. So right now we're in our current 5-year season structure, which started in 2020 and it'll end in 2024. So this is going to be the last year of the current season structure. So last year we started planning for the next season structure, which will be from 2025 to 2029. And so we're always sort of we don't get much time off between season structures before we start planning for the next one. It's kind of the nature of the game. But the season structure policy is really, really important because it is the policy that basically tells us when we conduct hunting seasons. If you start like for the rifle seasons, for example, right now we have a 5-day first rifle season followed by a 5-day break, which then, or a 9-day break, which then goes into a 9-day second season rifle season. And so the specific dates and times and breaks between seasons and lengths of seasons are all driven by our season structure policy. So it's really an important process for us. So fast forward to now, one of the topics that has been a big issue in Colorado, really it was a big issue during the last season structure planning as well, but for the current season structure process, we've highlighted it because both staff and the public consider it a significant issue, is over-the-counter hunting. And there's a lot of different discussions related to over-the-counter hunting, and you can break it up into archery versus rifle. The reality is, yes, right now we are talking about whether to continue to offer over-the-counter hunting opportunities for both archery and rifle. There was a milestone that happened recently. We had a Parks and Wildlife Commission meeting this month where it was sort of step one of the discussions for big game season structure. So staff recommendations were presented to the commission at the March commission meeting. And again, for folks that want to watch that and watch those discussions, they're recorded and archived on YouTube. But staff recommendation to the commission, as far as archery goes specifically, was to limit all licenses for residents and non-residents. So that would be very much different for archery seasons if the commission chose to approve that, to where you would, in the future, starting in 2025, an archery hunter would have to apply for a limited license to get a limited license to archery hunt in Colorado. And then, of course, the allocation provisions would apply and all those sorts of things would apply. So it'd be a very significant change. The commission is also considering, over-the-counter rifle licenses. Staff recommendation right now, as far as rifle licenses go, we have over-the-counter rifle licenses for bull elk available in our second and third regular rifle seasons. At the moment, the current staff recommendation was to not go to totally limited for rifle. There's some different issues and some different history to archery and rifle that we can talk more about here, but I think those changes may be coming down the road, as far as over-the-counter licenses no longer being available in Colorado, possibly. Doesn't mean we can't offer a lot of hunting opportunities still. It would just be a different system for getting a license, in folks' hands. And there's lots of discussion surrounding that. If folks are interested too, I imagine the agenda is still posted for the March commission meeting. There was a memo that was developed that went to the commission on the big game season structure, and there's a lot more detail in there as well. If folks are interested and want to read that memo, it's out there as well. So I'll start there. The rumors are true. Those conversations are happening right now in relation to our pending next 5-year season structure.
I wanted to come back to archery rifle, but maybe we'll hit that. You mentioned kind of some of the dynamics, history, et cetera, on why it sounds like more of a focus on unlimited archery at this point versus rifle. Can you expand on that?
So I guess what I will say to start is that during the last 5-year season structure, so the one we're currently in, there was a lot of discussion about limiting archery at that time, as well. So our conversations about archery go back, 10 years probably. And the reason why archery has been more of a focal point for these discussions over the last decade is because the growth and the interest that we've seen in archery hunting is different than rifle. The month of September is very appealing to folks. It's a long season. I guess there's lots of social media and hype surrounding archery. When I was a kid, nobody hunted with a bow, and if you did hunt with a bow, people looked at you kind of strange. Like, why would you do that? Versus now, when there's a lot of folks that, enter into the hunting arena with the bow and an archery tag. And so the scene out there is a lot different these days than it once was. And the reality is archery hunting is just very popular. So the growth we've seen in archery has been concerning from a crowding perspective. We have a lot of busy archery hunts and units in Colorado, and we've heard that from public and staff, just trying to find some elbow room out there, and the experience of those archery hunts has changed. And there's just a lot of conversation these days about crowding and the types of experience that hunters are looking for, and whether that's bulls that don't bugle as much and heavily hunted units, and there's all those conversations happening as well. But the reality is that archery hunter numbers and interest has grown significantly more than rifle hunters over time. And so we're trying to adapt to some of those issues. The other challenges we face significantly in Colorado that I think are underestimated by some, and I've, speaking professionally and personally over my career, our elk distribution and the number of elk that are available to public land hunters has changed significantly over the last 20 years. We have lots of elk that respond to hunting pressure and other pressures on the landscape by refuging on private lands and places where they're not accessible to hunters. In some places, it's national parks. Elk are very, very adept at finding those refuge areas where they're not vulnerable to hunting. And heavy hunting pressure influences where those animals are and the timing of when they move and how they're distributed over the landscape. And so that's something else that we're trying to triage. And that's a challenging one because there's not a silver bullet to it. But I think we have to recognize that hunting pressure plays a role in elk distribution. And if we want to continue to try to influence that and keep maximum numbers of elk on public lands, it's something we have to talk about in earnest. And so elk distribution is another topic. And, we know from studies, even studies 10, 15, 20 years ago now, that archery season and the September early seasons influence elk distribution and move elk around. So we want, there's an altruistic goal there of keeping elk on public land so that hunters' experiences are as good as they can be, while also minimizing conflicts with private lands and just letting public land users enjoy elk on public lands. Colorado is also a challenging place in 2024 because we have lots of people, non-hunters as well, that are everywhere wanting to do everything all the time. And so that's something we have to contend with as well. But recognizing that hunters influence elk distribution is important. There are instances where our elk herds are at population objectives, so we want to reduce cow elk harvest. Limited archery licenses are one way to influence that to some degree, but that's not sort of a widespread issue, I don't think, because archers, certainly don't have the success rates and the harvest power that rifle hunters do. So there's a variety of issues, but again, trying to address crowding, and some of the social desires of hunters these days, influence elk distribution, and then have the ability to start managing at a local level. As a professional wildlife manager, there's a lot of conversation to be had there. And I'm sure we'll probably talk a little bit about the severe winter in the Northwest region in Colorado last winter or 2 winters ago now, I guess. But having the ability to adapt to those sort of stochastic events, and have local control over our management while still being able to offer a lot of hunting opportunity. And I think, and I'm sorry, I'm talking a lot here. I'll stop in a second, but one final point. I think people equate limited licenses with, quality hunt codes and, those places where we severely restrict hunting opportunity, to grow trophy bulls or have maximum quality hunting experiences. And really, that's not what we intend here. I think we can find a balance where we can still continue to offer a lot of hunting opportunity, while also, enhancing the experience of the hunt with a little less crowding and things like that. So it's, our intent here is not to, bar the door and make this a once in a lifetime type hunting experience. We still need to manage our elk. We still want to offer a lot of opportunity for folks. And I think there'll be plenty for everybody, regardless of which way our commission ends up going.
And so this change, as you said, is eliminating over-the-counter for both residents and non-residents. So everything would fall under those quota numbers we talked about previously in terms of the allocation between resident and non-resident.
That is one scenario, and again, that was the staff recommendation. A qualifier to that, is that there is significant public sentiment and public interest in going to a model similar to what other Western states have currently, whereby resident remains OTC, so a resident could buy an over-the-counter license, and non-residents would be totally limited with licenses issued through a draw. So that's one of the bigger conversations that's happening on the heels of the commission meeting we had here a week or so ago. So again, the ultimate decision on these things will be in the hands of our commission. You know, the staff recommendations are just that. And we'll continue to have those conversations. The commission, I know, is going to continue to hear from hunters, both residents and non-residents, and we'll see where it goes. The big game season structure was intended to be kind of a three-step process. So we had our first meeting where staff recommendations were presented a week ago. The next meeting will be in May in Montrose, Colorado. I think it may be May 1st and 2nd. And then the final big game season structure will be adopted in June of 2024. So we have a ways to go still, and there's going to be a lot of both internal discussions and public discussions between now and then.
So between now and you said June would be the final ruling. Did I hear that right?
Correct. Yep.
Okay. Between now and June, folks listening to this podcast, residents, non-residents, et cetera, hunters who have an opinion and want their voice heard, what is the best way to do that? Is it at the commission meeting? Is there other ways of, obviously non-present contact, things of that sort, just so that hunters can voice their opinion perspectives between now and that decision coming in June?
Good question. I guess I should also throw out there that our commission, unfortunately, because of some pretty bad weather, the Front Range got a big blizzard the days around the commission meeting here in March. So the March commission meeting ended up being virtual, and because of that, our chairman and the commission decided to hold another in-person public meeting before the May meeting. So I believe that's April 5th. In Denver. So there's actually going to be a kind of a half day meeting in addition I haven't looked at the agenda yet, but I expect it'll largely focus on big game season structure topics. So there's going to be another one in April. So to answer your question, for residents, certainly residents are welcome to attend the commission meetings in person. When you do that, you can sign up to provide testimony so you can comment in person at the commission meetings. You kind of got to prepare because typically members of the public get 3 minutes, depending on how busy it is and how many people want to testify, but you get 3 minutes, so you sort of have to have your thoughts in order and maybe prepare ahead of time. But you can do that in person. Most of our meetings are virtual or a hybrid virtual these days. So there is opportunity to sign up to testify virtually as well. If you can't make the meeting in person, you just have to sign up to testify, I believe, like a week in advance. So you got to prep a little bit more if you want to testify virtually. The commission is also, on our Parks and Wildlife website. If you go to the commission page, all their emails are there, and they're used to that level of engagement. You can send our commission emails. You can send any of our staff emails, but if you want the commission to hear from you directly, you can send them emails. And you can also, they're busy folks. And, sometimes with topics like this where they're getting a lot of comment, they may not be able to get back to everybody, but occasionally you can get them on the phone as well if you coordinate that via email with them. But no commitments there that they're going to be able to get back to you on these big ticket topics. But I know they're reading emails. So that's definitely one way you could do it. And those are probably the best ways leading up to the different meetings to engage with our commission. CPW staff is always, I mean, we talk to people every day throughout our normal course of work, and we're always hearing those things, and all of the feedback and the comments and the discussion that we have at my level throughout the year certainly goes into the sausage making during these types of planning processes. So, I mean, we're engaging with folks throughout the year, and sometimes we're not able to support what the public may want, but we try to explain why that is and provide that rationale. And you know, it's our job to interject that professional perspective and the science and those factors. If we can include public sentiment and get us where we all want to be together, and everything is nice and congruent, you know, that's a perfect scenario. And a lot of times we do achieve that. There are instances where, you know, for different reasons, we take a little bit different course than the public we hear from may want. And though that can be challenging at times. You know, I'd like to think that we can agree to disagree and have professional discussions and try to achieve decent endpoints still and work forward on the next one. But you know, it is again, 2024 is a complicated place in Colorado. And we try to do our best to put the resource first and then manage for our constituents and provide as much good out there on the landscape as we can, as long as the resource is in good shape.
It sounds like too, I mean, you say we can't take all public input, you know, at times because it conflicts with, you know, science or what have you. I understand that. And that's for input coming to you, but also you, meaning Colorado Parks and Wildlife, or you as a game manager, you're making your staff recommendation to the commission, but the commission also may not take what you want, right? As we've said, like there's the, and when it comes to over-the-counter elk, there's the staff recommendation, but then there's these other ideas. So, if I heard correctly, the staff recommendation is no over the counter for residents or non-residents, but there's also another idea to limit non-residents only and still have over the counter for residents. So, just another example of the multiple layers of how these changes are happening.
That's correct. Yeah. And that's where, you know, kind of where science meets the social political realm. And that's the art of wildlife management. And our, you know, again, like the end goal is not to do anything that, long-term damages relationships. You know, I think that we have to just sort of come together as a hunting and angling community, wildlife conservation community, and understand that, you know, everyone is trying to do their best, and we don't always achieve a perfect outcome from where some people sit, but we still have to stay united and, you know, move on to the next issues, and, you know, just make sure that, you know, the resource is intact and sound, and remains the solid foundation for everything that's going to come afterwards. You know, because again, our state is changing so significantly and quickly these days that, you know, the goal of keeping elk on the mountain, you know, is going to take all hands on deck, to get the best outcomes in perpetuity. And so we want to stay friends and we want to hit good outcomes, and we're doing our best.
When it comes to, you know, let's say this next 5-year cycle, over the counter tags do go away, whether that's for everyone, residents and non-residents, or maybe it is just for non-residents. What has the discussion or idea, like, where is that number coming from? Where is the cap? Because you could go from over the counter, you know, unlimited selling this great number of licenses to now looking at, I'm assuming, what would be unit specific caps. Where is that coming from? Where's that number coming from?
It's a great question. And so again, a lot of these discussions about limiting over-the-counter licenses are based in, you know, a desire for a less crowded hunting opportunity experience. And so the reality is, going into this, like if we're going to influence crowding, we're going to have to look at some level of reduction. So we can't keep things status quo and just go limited, because that's not necessarily going to achieve one of the objectives of all of this and potential limitations. So what we've proposed preliminarily, is a 10% reduction to start. You know, we're going to have to ease into this so that, you know, hunters can adjust and strategize to the new norm. You know, hunting related businesses and local economies that derive income from hunting, you know, they can kind of adjust and adapt. because these are big changes and we recognize that. So we've proposed a 10% initial reduction to get things started. You are correct. What staff has recommended is that it would be either at the game management unit or the data analysis unit level. So we would have a whole bunch of new hunt codes where hunters would have to apply for their specific geographic area of interest where they want to hunt. And a data analysis unit basically is our herd management level. So we when we're drafting management objectives, we look at like an elk herd at a DAU level. And the idea is that that elk herd's overall range is encompassed by that geographic area. So a DAU, a data analysis unit, may include one or more game management units. So we could set licenses and create new hunt codes at the DAU level or the GMU level, depending on what fits for the local area. But hunters would have to apply for that specific geographic area where they want to go hunt. And we would probably start the conversations on the number of licenses based on a lot of times we look at the previous 3 year averages. So we could go back into our harvest data. You know, every year we collect harvest data for different reasons. And so we have an idea of how many archery hunters have hunted in different game management units and different data analysis units. We could look at the 3 year average number of licenses on that front. And then we could say, okay, if it was 1,000 hunters, or if it was 1,100 hunters and we wanted to round it to a round number and then reduce it by 10%, that could be our starting point. So again, like a 10% reduction is meaningful. It's meaningful both from a hunter opportunity standpoint and an economic standpoint for our agency. But that is what we've preliminarily proposed to get us started. And then after that, again, in the spirit of, you know, maybe hitting a sweeter spot for crowding and experience, while also maybe trying to address elk distribution and those other factors, you know, we could look at further reductions over time as hunters distribute themselves and, you know, the dust settles on who's applying where and how behavior changes on the application front.
Any change to, like, let's say theoretically this 10%, let's say that's what happens, right? Can that only be adjusted on this 5 year cycle, or can this 5 year cycle be built so that, hey, 10% is year one, but we have, you know, some sort of protocol to reassess hunter distribution, et cetera, and through this 5 year cycle, continue to make changes to that quota? Does that make sense?
Yes, no, it does. And the answer is we would have the ability to annually set license numbers
Okay.
and change license numbers within the 5 year season structure. You know, the fight it's good when the 5 year season structure would establish the policy that, you know, in this case, if over the counter archery licenses were totally limited by draw, that would be the baseline for the season structure. There might be a few more sideboards within there. Like year one is a 10% reduction. Years two through five, you know, will be at the discretion of local managers based on local conditions. So the commission could put a few more sideboards in there, but generally it would be an overarching policy that would establish the new norm of limitations.
Got it.
And we actually for rifle seasons, there's an alternative in the staff recommendation for the commission to consider. That was a phased in approach. So we could keep status quo and not go limited for OTC rifle licenses, or we could do a phased approach over the next 5 years. And folks can read about that in the memo on our website. But the idea there was, okay, rifle licenses are also going limited. Year one would just be establishing hunt codes, and we might not even do any reductions. Or potentially year two, we might not do any reductions. Year three, then folks have adjusted a little bit. Then we propose some reductions because the issues, especially with crowding, are typically the same with rifle hunters, although it's a little bit different. So yeah, we could do a phased in approach of limitations over the 5 year season structure as well. So we did present that as an alternative to the commission, if they wanted to take that on all at once. So we'll see what the commission decides to do.
Going back to setting quotas and this theoretical 10% reduction, you said, I believe, I'm not trying to put words in mouth, I'm trying to clarify that you'd be looking at things like harvest data, which makes sense. But with the way that hunter reporting happens in Colorado currently for over-the-counter opportunities, there isn't actual data on hunter distribution. Or is there? Meaning, like, I could have an over-the-counter archery elk tag. Let's say I hunted Colorado last fall, over-the-counter. Maybe I was out there for 10 days and hit five different units, or maybe I was out there 10 days and spent all my time in one unit, right? But there, I believe that the way hunter reporting happens, there isn't data on all of the units necessarily, or on the distribution from a hard data perspective on hunters. There's just data on hunter harvest. Is that correct?
Yeah, and when I say hunter harvest, that may be a little bit misleading, because when we do our harvest surveys, we're not, I mean, we are trying to get at the number of animals that were taken by GMU. But within that, we also get an idea of who's where. And so even if no animals were harvested, which is typically not the norm across all seasons, you know, we're also asking you during your surveys, you know, what units did you hunt? And if you harvested an animal, what unit it came from. So the results of the harvest survey do give us that insight into who's hunting where to give us a baseline starting point. You know, when you do have an over-the-counter license, I mean, it's not perfect because, like you just pointed out, you can hunt multiple GMUs during your hunt. So did you spend most of your time in unit 33, or did you spend most of your time in unit whatever, the neighboring unit that's over the counter? So there is some error associated with our harvest data, but we do get insight into who's where. And you know, I think in looking at the harvest data over time and you know, for management of our large populations of animals, you know, our harvest data tends to work fairly well and get us where we need to be. So it does provide that information for getting us started with the conversations on how many licenses to start with or issue in different game management units or DAUs.
So much in there on elk. That was great. I want to make sure we use our remaining minutes. And obviously, there's a lot of interest from hunters, questions from hunters, et cetera, on the big topic of wolves in Colorado. So, so many different things. I feel like there's a lot of information, misinformation, et cetera, out there. What can you guys share with us on where things are at, kind of with the state of the reintroduction releases? And then I ultimately want to talk about, from the department perspective, like future management as well. So, John, if you can kind of kick things off with where things are actually at right now.
Sure. And I guess let me do a brief kind of like, let's go back in time a little bit and see how we got where we are. And then I'll update like kind of where we are. Back in 2020, the voters of Colorado had Proposition 114 on the ballot in Colorado. And that was to reintroduce gray wolves to Colorado west of the Continental Divide. And that vote narrowly passed, and it enacted and basically told Colorado Parks and Wildlife to develop a plan to reintroduce gray wolves to the state of Colorado no later than December 31st of 2023. So after a lengthy stakeholder engagement process, meeting with livestock producers, the sportsman community, folks from, you know, all kind of walks of life in Colorado, and biologists and everybody else, we developed a pretty comprehensive plan to reintroduce wolves to the state. A lot of commission engagement, obviously, as part of that. That plan was passed at a commission meeting, I believe, May 4th of 2023. And it included everything from compensation for depredation incidents to, you know, how we were going to reintroduce the wolves. Just a huge comprehensive plan, anyway. So from that time, getting the plan approved May 4th, started working with partners to find where we might be able to source some of these wolves. The plan calls to introduce 10 to 15 wolves a year for the next 3 to 5 years. So basically looking at introducing 30 to 50 wolves in total over the next 3 to 5 years. Annually looking at the success of the program, whether they're denning and breeding and having pups, and just kind of assessing things on kind of a year-to-year basis for that 3 to 5 years. So came to an agreement with the state of Oregon this year to get as many as 10 gray wolves, and set out in December to go capture these wolves up in Oregon. Capture crew did a really remarkable job, and were able to get 10 gray wolves captured up there within about a week span. The initial release was 5 of those wolves in Grand County on the very first day. I believe that was December 18th, if my memory serves me well. And then throughout that next 4 or 5 days, we were getting another one or two here, and successfully got 10 of those wolves introduced into Colorado before the end of 2023. So where things are now is, we had already had some wolves from Wyoming naturally migrate down into Colorado. Only two of those animals are still alive and in Colorado and are collared as well. So we have 12 collared gray wolves in Colorado right now that our biologists and wolf program managers are able to kind of track. Now, when I say track, we don't have minute by minute updates on where these wolves are. We kind of get a GPS ping every few hours letting us know kind of where they've been, but not exactly where they are at that specific moment. And we've been releasing a map on the Colorado Parks and Wildlife website once a month. I believe it's supposed to be like the fourth Thursday of every month or something like that. The details areas where the wolves have kind of dispersed or been. Again, it doesn't show you exactly where they are at that moment, but does show that they've kind of ranged out a little bit as expected, getting familiar with their territory. But as of now, we have 12 collared gray wolves, the 10 that were re reintroduced, and then the two that had naturally come down from Wyoming. And I think that's kind of where things stand right now.
Those wolves from Wyoming, they were previously collared. I mean, that's why you know that they were present and from Wyoming. Is that how that happened?
No, we actually put those collars out ourselves. Had been getting some reports from folks letting us know. And it's actually kind of interesting, the timing of that is that those wolves kind of showed up in Colorado pretty quickly right after Proposition 114 had passed, if my memory serves me right, Brandon. But yeah, just interesting timing with that pack. They did come down, successfully have a litter, which was the first litter of gray wolf pups that I think have been born here in a really long time. I don't remember the exact number. But then some of those wolves did go back north of the state line up to Wyoming and were killed up there in Wyoming, where they're not a listed endangered species in that state. So that's where there was a pack here, but now it's just down to the two animals that are still in Colorado.
The wolves that were reintroduced, brought from Oregon, the location for the release and reintroduction, how was that established?
Yeah, a lot of factors. We put it in the restoration plan that reintroduction would happen 60 miles from any of our state borders. Really hoping to, keep those animals in Colorado and not roaming directly and quickly into other states. We do know, wolves are, we're not going to be able to predict their movements. They are going to, look to set up packs and territories and, can travel long distances. And but as part of that plan, wanted to keep that reintroduction area 60 miles away from any of our state borders, or as well as our tribal territories. So we do have the Ute Mountain Utes and the Southern Mountain Ute, or Southern Ute, I should say, here in Southwest Colorado, and we're kept that 60-mile boundary from their tribal lands as well. Now, two kind of key areas were identified as places to consider for reintroduction. A larger circle was kind of in Grand and Summit counties north of Interstate 70, And that's where these first wolves went. Second area that was identified is south of I-70, more in Brandon's country here. And could certainly probably anticipate a reintroduction at some point in the next 3 to 5 years happening south of I-70, kind of more in Brandon's country. A lot of factors went into that, including some social science on where were wolves viewed a little bit more favorably. Obviously, key concerns were good habitat, that 60-mile buffer from other states, but various factors went into the selection of those locations.
This, so there's a mandate on coming years, more the numbers, I guess, that will be continued to be brought into the state.
Yeah,
What
so the
is,
plan calls. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
no, go ahead, clarify. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, just, the plan does call for that 30 to 50 wolves being reintroduced. I think the idea. And Brandon, correct me if I'm wrong, but the plan called for, management of, once we have, pups being born in the state, looking at around like 150 wolves, kind of total, but looking at, yeah, go ahead, Brandon.
I could jump into that a little bit more, John. So yeah, as John said, for the first 3 to 5 years, it was kind of a transplant 10 to 15 wolves per year for 3 to 5 years. After that, and I think we had intended on talking about some of your listeners had asked about population objectives, and I think this is a your folks, your listeners will find this interesting, because when we wrote the wolf reintroduction plan, and we didn't set a population objective, the management approach is based on what we call phases. And so essentially, to move between the phases is based on minimum winter counts of wolves. Which I don't. I think we're currently trying to develop that protocol for our winter surveys and minimum counts. And so moving between the phases will be based on the number of wolves that we observe during those minimum counts moving into the future. And the phases are essentially, they're sort of in sync with the different listing statuses. So right now, I think folks are aware that in Colorado, gray wolves are endangered. So they're endangered as a state animal, and they're also federally endangered. And so we have essentially some oversight from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We're doing the management on the ground, but the Fish and Wildlife Service still has the jurisdiction, because it's a federally listed animal. So to move from a state, endangered animal to a state threatened animal, that would be a minimum winter count of 50 animals for 4 consecutive years. And then the next phase, once we move from a state endangered to a state threatened animal, to move from a threatened to a delisted non-game species in Colorado would be a minimum winter count of 150 wolves for 2 consecutive years, or 200 wolf minimum count on any given year. And so then the idea there is that once you move through those phases and the gray wolf is delisted in Colorado and then is considered a non-game species in Colorado, that would then give the state full management oversight. There'd be no more U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service jurisdiction, because it's no longer a listed species under the Endangered Species Act. And then at that point, there's really no commitments within the wolf management plan. I think the idea was then, okay, obviously the program's been successful. There's good numbers of wolves. They're spread out over large geography. What is the next step for management? And we'll take those conversations on when we get there. But there is not a hard and fast population objective outlined in the management plan.
So is it the case that all wolves being released are collared?
Yeah, correct. Any of the wolves that are captured and released will get collared. Now, that's not to say that every wolf in Colorado will always be collared. We're not going to be
Sure.
going out to dens and collaring the pups
Exactly.
and whatnot, but those initial reintroduced wolves will all get collars.
Okay. So
Yeah, and so
every
it's a really important point, Mark, because yes, the transplanted wolves will be collared, but right now is the breeding season for wolves.
And I'm not sure what exactly is happening there. I'm not necessarily in those loops, but our biologists and our wolf folks are keeping tabs on this. We may have uncollared wolves on the ground here in a couple months if some of these wolves pair up
Right.
and reproduce. So, it's going to be here pretty quick where we'll have lots of collars for the first few years, but we also are going to quickly have wolves that are uncollared and moving around the landscape as well.
Which is when those winter counts come into play.
Right, exactly. Yep. So we need another way of getting, an index to the population trends.
Okay. Is there, I know the release, like part of the regulation or, rules around that. You said 60 miles away from state borders, but also wolf travels pretty unpredictable and can be pretty wide ranging, both ingoing and outgoing in this case. They have no idea of state boundaries. Is there any cooperation or collaboration with, say, Wyoming about management or anything of that sort? I mean, just to pick Wyoming as one state, because we obviously know there's already been border crossings, again, kind of regardless of direction.
Yeah, we don't have that agreement. Nothing with Wyoming. Back in September, we did sign agreements with Arizona, Utah, and New Mexico, where if wolves do wander there, that they could capture them and relocate them back to Colorado, and we'd work with that with them on that if they want to bring those animals back. But currently, it's just with those three neighboring states and not with Wyoming.
You guys have been super gracious with time. Thank you. I know we certainly didn't answer every question, whether it's about wolves or elk or anything. I mean, and there's so many other topics we didn't get to, and as we've said, such big and complex and multifaceted topics. But thank you for sharing what you could and sharing the time that you can today. Just a recap from either of you, kind of open floor to let people know. I mean, we've already mentioned some great resources and things to check out, but just anything else that you want to leave listeners with? We can start with you, Brandon.
I know everybody's time is precious, but I will say that there's a tremendous amount of information on the Colorado Parks and Wildlife website. Sometimes you got to click through it and learn how to navigate a little bit, but I mean, whether you're looking for limited license draw statistics, population statistics, the wolf management plan, there's just a lot of information for folks to dive into there. So I would really encourage people to do that just so that they have facts in hand and they can participate to the degree they think is necessary. The only other thing that we didn't cover, Mark, that I'll just touch on real quick, and is as far as like future license management and big game population management, whether you're talking about wolves or whatever the case is, because there are a lot of factors that influence our big game populations. Colorado manages based on herd management plans that have specific objectives in them. Most of the time, it's a population objective and then a male to female ratio objective. And our goal every year is to hit those objectives that are in our herd management plans. So, I mean, every year we're looking at all the data that we have available to us, whether it's harvest data, whether it's radio collar data, all of those different metrics that we have to look at, and we're trying to base our license recommendations to achieve our herd management plan objectives. And so that process never ends. We do that within the sideboards of the big game season structure, and we're just always trying to hold our populations at those objectives. So, I'm not sure that a lot of folks understand that. If we're increasing licenses or decreasing hunting licenses, it's still in the spirit of achieving our herd management plan objectives. That is our mandate. So, just something to point out to your listeners, and maybe we can talk more about that in another podcast or down the road, but there's a lot that goes into our annual recommendations, and we try to use the best and most current science and data available to us and to keep those herds within the sideboards that we've set through our commission approval process and public engagement processes.
Anything for you, John?
Yeah, and just to add to that, there's just so many factors that contribute to, all of our management, whether that's habitat loss or, drought, disease, vehicle collisions, whether it's, predators, hunter harvest. It's just there's so many factors that go into all the decisions that get made, and just a lot of kudos to Brandon and his team and all of our biologists and the wildlife officers who kind of come together. Colorado's out monitoring these herds on a yearly basis and setting licenses on a yearly basis. And I don't know if the public always understands just truly how much time and effort goes into that. And then obviously with the herd management plans, it's just a huge lift for all the biologists and the area staff and the folks who are on the ground and see what's going on with those herds and those animals on a daily basis or out in their district. So I just really want the public to understand just like what a huge lift and process that is. And it's because we all love the resource, are out doing our best to protect that resource on a daily basis here. And we just also encourage the public, get involved. Don't think, oh, at these commission meetings or when we're asking for folks to go on the CPW Engage website to provide public comments that, somebody else has already probably voiced an opinion like mine. I don't need to submit my comment. I think those public comments go a long way, and don't just assume that somebody's already voicing the concern that you have and that we're hearing that. Make sure you're getting involved too. And can't say enough for what that public comment period really does mean. We're managing the resource, the way the public would like us to manage it. We're tasked with that as well. So just really encourage folks to make sure they get involved with that process.
Well, there you have it. Thanks again to John and Brandon for joining us today. Thank you guys for listening and supporting the show. Once again, it would help us tremendously if you can leave a rating or review on whatever podcast app that you're using. And if you have any questions for us, you can always get in contact with us by sending an email to podcast@exomountaingear.com. Thank you so much for supporting the show. We'll be back with a bonus episode this Friday. That is a great one, so you don't want to miss it. So again, just make sure you are subscribed and you will receive all future episodes for free. Talk to you soon.